Good morning. To talk at the truth. That's you guys. That's us. How wondrous. Very grateful to be here. Grateful that Sosan would invite me to come here, and for all the good friends that I've been able to spend the morning with so far, for all of you being here. I am going to talk today about this book that I wrote, Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara. And a friend of mine was talking to a friend of his. He said, yeah, my friend wrote a book. And his friend said, oh, yeah, what's it called? And he said, well, it's called Inside Vasubandhu's Yogacara. And she said, I only know one of those words. So this is a big mistake. Did not Dogen Zenji say that the practice of Zen is one mistake after another? So this book, maybe I'll begin by talking about Vasubandhu for a minute. So Vasubandhu is a 5th century Indian monk, and he was incredibly prolific and probably one of the greatest geniuses in Buddhist history. So here this morning we chanted the names of our ancestors, and like all Zen ancestor chants, it included the name of Vasubandhu. And at the name of Vasubandhu, the Doshi put his head down on the cushion and did a bow. In the Tibetan tradition, Vasubandhu is also understood to be what they call the six ornaments. I don't know the other five because they have Tibetan names. But anyway, so he's been revered for 1,500 years in both Chinese and Tibetan Zen. But amazingly, he was also incredibly influential in Indian Buddhism. And what makes him kind of extraordinary is that he started out as, you may not know these distinctions well, but he started out basically as a Theravadan Buddhist. And he wrote one of the most authoritative texts in the world on Theravadan Buddhism that's been studied now for 1,500 years. And then he changed his mind and he became a Mahayana guy. And he wrote what became some of the most central and seminal texts of Mahayana Buddhism. So what I'll compare this to is if Martin Luther had said, you know, this Catholicism just doesn't work, I'm changing my ways, and founded Protestantism, but Catholics still said he was one of the most authoritative teachers of the Catholic tradition. The comparison I prefer, though, is if Jimi Hendrix had survived his addiction and become one of the greatest composers of orchestral music, so that in 500 years people said Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and Hendrix, but they still talked about him as one of the most innovative and revolutionary figures in popular music as well. So an extraordinary guy. And let me ask you this. Have people heard of the story of the Monkey King? I mean, they made a Disney movie out of it. That's how popular it is. I read this to my son when he was young, and it's a story of this mythical monkey who takes a monk to China to get texts to bring back. And this is actually a mythologized version of the story of an actual guy named Xuanzang. Xuanzang's seminal and most important text was his commentary on Vasubandhu's 30 verses. This is mine. So I'm hoping that in 500 years there's a story about me walking to the bookstore to get books with a really powerful monkey. So one of the reasons that Vasubandhu was able to maintain authority in these different traditions was his tendency to approach the Dharma with an enormous amount of intellectual and practical awareness, but with a kind heart. So actually, if you read a lot of ancient Indian Buddhist texts, a lot of them are very argumentative, and they often put down their opponents. You may not like this. I don't actually like it that much, but it's really true. I mean, our founder, Dogen Zenji, sometimes gets pretty ornery. I like it when he calls people, these bald-pated rascals. He's talking about monks he doesn't like. So you see a lot of sort of acrimonious debate among Buddhist traditions. And Vasubandhu didn't bring that acrimonious flavor into his work. And this is one of the main reasons that I am interested in what he does, because I don't think we need more acrimony. I don't think we need it within our tradition, and I don't think we need it anywhere. And you guys might have noticed that there's a kind of an acrimonious atmosphere here in our U.S. of A. Maybe it's just me. I don't know. Maybe it's just me and everyone I know who's freaking out right now. But I don't think we're going to help by putting more acrimony into it. I really don't. You might, and that's okay. Anyway, his shift from being focusing on early Buddhist-style teachings to Mahayana came as he became one of the progenitors of what was called the Yogacara tradition. So we have Vasubandhu, that's the guy, and Yogacara, which is the tradition. And Yogacara, the word means yoga practice. So this does not mean that Vasubandhu was the greatest guy at standing on his head. What you may or may not know is yoga, in its original meaning, means union or to yoke together, and is about, you could say, yoking the self to the infinite, or you could just say about bringing things into harmony. So the practice of doing a lot of stretching and bending is actually like a tiny, tiny corner of what yoga has historically meant. So the Yogacara tradition really was about harmonizing early Buddhist thought with the revolution of Mahayana thought. So you guys may not even know what I'm talking about, but if you read a Zen text and you compare it to an ancient early Buddhist text, they're super different. I mean, you might be like, how are these even related? And so Vasubandhu's interest was in harmonizing these views. And the interest was, I think, in part, kind of like, you know, maybe he's like a younger brother. I just want everyone to get along. So maybe just some psychological basis that's probable. But what's expressed in the teachings of the 30 verses, which is what my book is a commentary on, his 30 verses on Yogacara, is he realized that early Buddhism was excellent at, it was a very complex and well-developed system for psychological development. So it was like a set of practices you could do so you could go from suffering to non-suffering. But if you read a lot of Zen texts, they're like, what method? Why are you sitting? Just realize the way right now. Everything's already infinitely connected. So Mahayana came along and said, this system is too complicated, and it's all about getting from here to there, and here is already complete. Here is already complete, which is true. This is completeness. But both views have value, and Yogacara shows how they work together better in tandem rather than separate. So I'm not here to critique Theravadin style Buddhism because I'm not absorbed in that. But in Zen, sometimes if you only stuck to Chinese text, you would really be missing a lot of the enormous transformative power of early Buddhist psychology. The only thing is, in the U.S., everyone's already infused with psychology, so Zen is already basically Yogacara. So the problem is, I'm here making an argument for this tradition that you're probably already doing. You're like, well, of course it's psychological. But that's because we're already tapping into this thing that's in there. But I will say that, you know, so we're putting this together. Psychology is being integrated with Zen practice sort of naturally in our culture because that's just how we are. But Vasubandhu showed how to do it in an incredibly brilliant way that really honored both sides of the tradition. And so I'll compare this to the reason I think we should be studying this is that I will compare it to if someone comes to me and says, I want to learn to play blues guitar. I really like Kenny Wayne Shepherd. You guys don't know who that is. Well, I'll try Eric Clapton. You heard of him? And I'll say, cool, let's learn some Eric Clapton. But I'll say, why don't we learn how to play Elizabeth Cotton? Why don't we learn how to play Robert Johnson? And why don't we learn how to play Bessie Smith? Because these are the people who formulated this tradition. These are the masters from which those other people's work was derived. Or if you want to write a novel, read some Jane Austen. Don't just read The New Yorker. It's good, but go back. There's a depth to practice that can be found by touching the old masters of a form. So, Yogacara brings psychological insight to Zen, and it brings the enormous emphasis on altruism to early Buddhist thought. So, let me move along here. Yes. So, Yogacara is really closely equated with the tradition called consciousness-only Buddhism, which basically has to do with the fact that consciousness is, it's a word that could mean a lot of things, but maybe I'll say it could also mean experience, just this moment of experience only. And so consciousness only is about saying this moment of experience is where you can practice, it's where you can do something, it's where your empowerment resides, so focus on that. I'm going to read a little passage from this book. This book is designed around each chapter as a commentary on a line of Vasubandhu's 30 verses. And by the way, the 30 verses, it's a poem, but a friend of mine says, oh, you're doing poetry. Well, read me a line of the poem. And I read it, and he said, that's not poetry. So this is, Yogacara is known for being extraordinarily complex and impenetrable. But the whole purpose of this book is I read a lot of books about it, and I said, this is beautiful, powerful work. So the intent of this is to make something that's been thought inaccessible by many people accessible to an average person who just wants to do practice, wants to find a way to be peace, to enact peace, and to make peace for themselves and others. So the first line is, everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. Everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. I invite you to take a moment to investigate what you are experiencing right now. In all likelihood, you have a sense of being in a location, perhaps in a chair or a bed or a zafu. There are sensations in a body that you think of as yours. There is a visual field that can be scanned from left to right, that is to say, from what you probably think of as your left and right. There are things behind you that you cannot see but you can feel, the soft back of a chair perhaps. There are words in front of you that you conceive to be my words, that you would likely say that you are reading. We can divide everything in this moment of experience into things that we conceive to be ourselves and things that we conceive to be other than ourselves, with ourselves unconsciously placed in the center. Whether we know it or not, this division and this self-centering is constantly occurring, and this division and the problems it causes and the possibility of transcending them through intimacy with them is the principal subject of the 30 verses. A brief investigation of our consciousness like the one above is likely to lead us to the idea that we have a consciousness that experiences things. That is to say, consciousness is self and the world around us is other. At the start of this work, Vasubandhu points toward another view. Everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. Neither the self nor the other is consciousness. They are merely conceptions occurring within a process of consciousness. The transformation of consciousness is a constant flow. If you look at experience, there are not fixed elements or even moments. There is simply a process, a transformation. The first thing these verses give us is an opportunity to experience a sense of wonder about what we are experiencing right now. A sense that our most basic understanding of where and what we are in the world is not quite right. That we are instead involved in a mysterious, flowing unfolding. We see this teaching reflected in the Tibetan classic, The 37 Practices of the Bodhisattva by Tokme Songpo. Whatever arises in experience is your own mind, says Songpo. Mind itself is free of any conceptual limitations. Know that and don't generate self-other fixations. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. End quote. Consciousness only puts forth the split between subject and object as the ultimate aspect of our consciousness we must see through if we want to realize our capacity to appear in the world in a purely kind and joyful way. As we will see at the end of the 30 verses, letting go of the sense that we are a self experiencing things, is the way to enter this mysterious flowing unfolding, so that whatever is here that we might call ourselves is just a natural, generous, joyful, compassionate occurrence. The Buddha called himself Tathagata, or that which is thus coming and going. He described himself merely as a flowing occurrence, and the outward form that took was constant, calm, compassionate availability to people who came to him for help. This is the way of being these verses offer to you. So, this text, and really Buddhism in general, emphasizes transformation by investigating our experience now. And I think these days people are like, a lot of people are like, oh my God, I don't have time to sit down. I have to go out and fix everything because it looks kind of scary out there in the world. So this is kind of a counter view. But the idea is, if you could transform your consciousness, say, through practice, there's two basic modes of practice suggested by Yogacara. One is calming harmful emotions and cultivating beneficial ones. And the other is realizing your interdependence with everything. So if you were to do that, and you found yourself manifesting only energy and kindness and compassion and nonviolence, and you didn't manifest a lot of anger and hatred and dissatisfaction, and everything you saw, you realized you were profoundly connected to it, what would you do? What would you do? See, the illusion people have is that you cannot be doing something. That can't happen. Everything's already doing. You're already part of that doing. So even if you try and subtract yourself from it, you're just making another illusion of subtraction. So if you focus on transforming consciousness, you will already be enacting peace, always, because you're already a part. Bell Hooks is a wonderful writer, an African-American feminist from like the second wave era. By the way, isn't the basic dictum of second wave feminism the personal is the political? Sounds familiar to what I'm saying here and to what Yogacara is saying. Bell Hooks says, there must exist a model for social change that includes ways to transform consciousness that are linked to efforts to transform structures. So, interesting. Anyway, so this text basically says, what it kind of upholds is the idea that this early Buddhism has this excellent model for psychological transformation, and that Mahayana has this great model for just radically entering interdependentness. And so it breaks into two sets of teachings. One is called the Eight Consciousness Model, which is a model of consciousness that allows you to work with it. And, eight sounds like a lot. You're like, couldn't we have three? Because Freud had three. Freud was smarter. You make it a little easier. Id, ego, superego. So Yogacara has eight, but actually it's kind of three because the first six are just sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and mind. So six of the consciousnesses are just basic senses. I'm not going to get into the details of what the other two are because they're kind of freaky. Read the book. Freaky stuff is cool. Anyway, but this is a central term of Yogacara thought, eight consciousness model. And then the side of Yogacara that kind of taps more into Mahayana thought is called the three natures model, which I'll talk about in a minute. So the eight consciousness model basically sets it up so we have an idea that there's a process in which you can participate which will condition the mind to create more beneficial states. And this is just obvious, right? Is there anyone, I mean, would you be sitting here if you didn't think you could be more well by doing this practice? So no matter how many times your Zen teacher says, you're going nowhere, this is it, you're like, yes, and I'm going to come back tomorrow because I would like to feel better. Or maybe, you know, I would like other people to feel better. Because consciousness, it's interdependent. So your consciousness is connected to other people. If you're well, it's time to realize that your wellness is an opportunity to connect with others. So the idea is you can plant seeds of wellness and you can let go of seeds of harm. And I just want to quote good old Black Elk here, the Lakota sage, who said, there can never be true peace between nations until there is true peace in the hearts of men. And I will add, women. So I'm going to read a couple passages here, one about this model for transforming consciousness. So in the chapter 13, Taking Care of Suffering, I quote, I got the wrong one here, sorry. Oh, my friends. Okay, yeah, here we go. So there's a whole section in here about how to cultivate good seeds and feel good. But, you know, we're Buddhists, so let's talk about suffering. I'm sorry. But we take care of it because it's real. If it wasn't real, we wouldn't bother. If you don't have any suffering and no one else does, just go make lunch. So there's a whole list of factors of experience that are painful or harmful listed here. And so I'm going to talk about why that's there in the text. Like some modern psychological methods, Buddhist practice sometimes encourages us to consciously draw difficult emotions into our mind and body. By allowing ourselves to experience afflictive states in the light of mindfulness and in the light of our commitment to the alleviation of suffering, we can directly experience the fruits of afflictive karma and let it go. Even including a list of afflictions in this text is an example of this approach. When one reads this list, it probably takes the mind to a darker place than it was at before. This list is here to help us face the difficult things that we'd like to avoid or blame on someone else. Stories actually serve in part this purpose of bringing afflictions into our mind. In most cultures, stories include challenges or difficulties. And when we hear them, we may experience fear, anxiety, or anger, as well as joy, tranquility, and laughter. Just look at the anxious faces of young children being told the story of Little Red Riding Hood as she sits on the bedside with the malicious and deceitful predator. How many tissues have been soaked during viewings of the movie Brokeback Mountain? We have these stories in some part because we need to know that we are not alone with our pain, that someone else is crying as the aged, fading King Lear rages at his loving, devoted daughter. Many stories from the Buddhist canon, particularly those from the Theragata, the record of the first order of nuns, tell of terrible sufferings. I vividly recall one retreat in the steep, lush hills of southern Minnesota where my teacher Tim Burkett told the story of the unbelievably bereft Patachara. She lost her children and entire family in a series of shocking tragedies, and she eventually made a commitment to practice and became one of the greatest teachers of her time. I wept copiously. My heart cracked wide by hours of meditation, the power of the story, and my teacher's gift for storytelling. I tasted the raw pain of her loss as my own. I saw it in my own consciousness. I left that retreat with an open heart, a newfound knowledge of my capacity to be with my own suffering, and a deepened sense of the vastness of my connection to all of life through the bond of shared grief. Stories, of course, only go so far at helping us be well. Although they allow us to sense, generally unconsciously, that we are not alone with our pain, most of us don't attend too closely to the experience of the affliction that arises we tend to focus on the story. In order to see the ultimate benefits of drawing into mind the difficulties of life, we need to do it in the context of our vow to end suffering and with our attention focused on actually seeing the painful states as they arise in our mind and body. We need to practice right mindfulness. So this text has these super long lists. It's got like 52 factors of experience. I used to read this and just be like, oh, man, Buddhists and their lists. What is he doing? And then I had a shocking flash of the obvious. 45 of the things listed were emotional. So it says, yes, you should look at your consciousness. It's important to pay attention to what is in your experience and have some sense of what it is. And 90% of that energy should go towards being mindful of your emotions. I'm sure this is the way you live. Just moment to moment, never really focusing on external phenomena and how they... And the reason is, our emotional projections are unbelievably powerful in making the image we have of what life is. Is that not true? You know, just imagine you meet someone coming off a plane. Maybe you know these two people in your life. Maybe not. I do. Someone who gets, every time they get off a plane, they'll, you go, how was it? And they go, oh, it's pretty good. No, it's nice. The other person will go, I don't know. I got there and the line was so long and I couldn't believe it. They kept poking at me in the... You know, one person is always this list of sufferings, and it's, why is that? It's just conditioning. I mean, certainly external circumstances matter. It's not that they don't matter, but the thing is, your power resides in transforming your view. Then you can continually act in a way that benefits everyone. So, stories are good. As I was reading, I think stories are really great. But they're a little bit limited, right? So the idea is, my stories are helpful, help me to remember to go to work. Work exists. That's a story. Money exists. Just a story. Crazy fabric. Ash, birds. Hey, birds, does money exist? What do you want to be? Just listening to stories all the time or flying? In a vast, empty sky. So mindfulness of emotions is one of the principal, two main practices suggested by this text, mindfulness of emotion, and then awareness of interdependence is the second one. So stories only go so far, so there are ways to dive below them. One is to just go, okay, I'm going to let go of these words and see how I feel. But another is to use cognitive and meditative approaches to dissolve the propensity of the mind to constantly generate stories. So then we get into the really trippy stuff here. So I'm going to read about the three natures, and a couple people here, oh yeah, I get that. And then half of you will be like, what? Well, it's all right. This material isn't easy, so you don't have to feel, you shouldn't feel like you're, you know, dumb. Don't feel dumb. Never do that. Don't talk down to yourself. So anyway, but I'll try and make this as clear as I can. But it's complicated. So the first line in his exposition of the three natures, which are imaginary nature, other dependent nature, and complete realized nature. I think Reb Anderson usually calls them imputational nature, dependent nature, and something else. Anyway, he talks about these a lot. So get ready. So Vasubandhu says, whatever thing is conceptualized by whatever conceptualization is of an imaginary nature. Since everything conceived as self or other is conceptualized, that means everything you experience is imaginary, according to this teaching. So that's weird. I'll admit it. But it's therapeutic. That's the point. Liberative. Here, Vasubandhu begins his teaching on the Yogacara model for understanding phenomena as having three natures, the imaginary nature, the other dependent nature, and the complete realized nature. This model of understanding is designed to enable us to realize the depth of our delusion. to enable us to realize the completeness of our connection to all things, and to the dynamism, unknowability, and liberation possible when we realize this delusion and intimacy with everything. The imaginary nature of things is our projections and beliefs. The utter dependent nature of things is that they are merely being manifestations of infinite conditions. The complete realized nature is beyond all dualistic views. This doctrine of three natures has a close kinship with the more commonly known Mahayana teachings on the idea of absolute and relative natures, or the two truths doctrine. When you look at an object, or a person, or an emotion, you can see the three natures in each of these things. Using the example of a tree, for instance, we could say that a tree has many characteristics that you know and understand. It is itself, distinct and separate from other things. This is its imaginary nature. The conceptual habits of your consciousness construct it. Of course, many people would agree about its nature and characteristics, for we have extremely similar conceptual conditioning. The tree also has utter dependent nature. It is sunshine, seeds, air, earth, rain. The elements upon which it depends are infinite, including every drop of rain that has ever fallen on earth, which are all connected, and your gaze as you look at it, without which it would not be the thing you perceive, and all the infinite conditions that came to create that gaze. We have not even begun to scratch the surface of the tree's dependence on other things. The complete realized nature is beyond any conceptions, although it excludes nothing. It is not the imaginary, and it is not the utter dependent, and is not either, not other than either of them, either. Buddhism is fun, guys. It's play. In the Song of the Grasser of Hermitage, Shirto says, "The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. The complete realized nature is vast, inconceivable. We can provisionally call it a source because without it we could not experience the imaginary nature of things that we take to be reality. It can't be faced or turned away from. It's both beyond grasping and always right here and now." Perhaps this all seems rather heady. I mean, really, it's a tree. Look at it. Actually, just stopping and looking at a tree is a good way to allow the mind time and space to soften and open up to a sense of these three natures. To stop and look at a tree allows the mind to touch something in an intimate way and to relax the pace of trying to figure things out. This can plant a seed of presence, and someday you may see a tree in complete realization, beyond and intimate with all your ideas about it and your total connection to it and interdependence with everything. Imaginary nature opens up the possibility of profound humility. How much suffering that we experience is dependent on us thinking we know what's going on, having it all figured it out, and it won't go our way. The utter dependent nature, intimacy, connection. It feels good to realize that we're not alienated. And the complete realized nature, well, I won't get any words about that. But this emphasis on interdependence is powerful. And I've eaten up all the time, so I can't do Q&A, but I will end with a quotation, two quotations. From one is about the interdependent nature, and the other is about the Bodhisattva vow. One is from Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. He says, "I am cognizant of the interrelatedness of all communities and states. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not worry about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny." And Rosa Parks said, "I would like to be known as someone who wanted to be free so others could also be free." So it's been lovely to have an opportunity to talk here at this community, which I admire and always feel so good when I get to visit. And I thank you all.
Actually, we do have a couple minutes.
Oh, we do?
Which I will start out by saying that there will also be books for sale and that Ben will be signing afterwards if you're interested. I will be at a table out in the main room here as well afterwards. But we have a couple of minutes for questions too.
Comments, questions, songs or dances? Yeah, I just quoted that because I noticed that there was this exact reflection in the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva of this teaching, but that's the only reference to that particular text in this book. So I pull through 1,500 years of Buddhist thought to illustrate how Vasubandhu's teaching connects to these ways of practice, and that was just one example of that. It's a beautiful text, though. Bodhisattva. Yeah.
Do you have any suggestions about how to become informed about the different flavors of Buddhism? I think in a lot of ways, Christianity is easier. There's one book. I mean, it's more complicated than that. And I come here and I'm dabbling and I thought, okay, well, I'll read this. Okay, I'll read that. And I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea there are all these different flavors. So what do you suggest to try to begin to understand the complexity of all this?
Yeah, you know what I would suggest is, I don't have a particular book I would suggest. I would suggest let that be a small part of your practice, and that desire to know, just let that guide some inquiry, maybe with the teachers here who might have better resources at the top of their head than I do right now. But let that be a small part and kind of live with the confusion of it.
Okay, that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. but you know, keep learning a little bit, but don't get, that can be kind of frustrating. You're like, what is all this stuff? Mm. And some people are going to talk about stuff that's very confusing, and sometimes you just go, okay, whew, that's all right. And then something touches your heart and hold to that.
I guess my motivation behind it is trying to understand the context that these different teachings happening in. And
yeah.
That's where this is coming from. Not so much of fear of confusion, like acceptance of confusion, but wanting to have a deeper understanding.
Yeah. Well, you know, take classes, take time to meet with teachers, and they might have a reading list here. I don't have a great book that's like, it wouldn't be great if there's the one great book that really laid that out, but there really isn't.
Okay. That's
so.
Your next book?
Perhaps. I gotta go. Thank you, Bonnie. That's a great idea. That is a great idea. So,
I'm still unless Corrine.
Oh, we wait till we see human beings manifesting.
You can keep going.
Okay.
Until the kids line up.
Keep playing. Keep playing.
In a way, it
required 30 times as much research as my first book. So the book on Shito's Song of the Grass of Hermitage, on which my first book was a commentary, it's what is extraordinary for is being accessible. So the fact that I chose one of the most notoriously inaccessible texts for my second book is strange. But the thing is, they both touched my heart. So I am fortunate in that I trust my heart. And I said, well, I think this has something to offer, so I will do the work. But I read a lot of very large books, which I could barely understand. And there are parts still where I'm reading the second time, I'm like, what is that? Because they're written by philosophers, a lot of them. But the writing of it wasn't hard. No. No, I like making things up. Yes?
So from what I know about Dogen, there's a lot of emphasis on, like, Zazen. Does Vasubandhu also have that emphasis as well. I mean, since he's such a brilliant person, like, is, you know, like, there's a lot up here, but there's also what's how do you see his commitment to sitting?
Yeah, it's unknown. So it's really interesting. There's these people who are like, Yogacara was all about reclaiming Buddhism for practice because it's called the yoga practice tradition, and yoga meant meditation to everyone in India. There are other people who are like, it's so complicated, they must have been sitting around thinking all the time. So I don't know, but what this book does is it takes the 30 verses is Vasubandhu's most concise and practical text. So basically, I looked at it and I said, it clearly outlines that you should be mindfulness of emotion. That should be one of your principal practices. And the other one should be objectless meditation, which is basically what Dogen teaches, which people often will say is an innovation of Dogen, but I would say it's deeply embedded in Yogacara and explicated in various ways from even before Vasubandhu. So I don't know, but what I recommend is practice. So the idea of this is to take something complicated and make it accessible and show how it is about doing your life for the liberation of everyone, including doing your life doing nothing. It helps. It's inspiring. Yes.
Do I hear sound? Not yet. Okay, go ahead.
Things I practice the most is pushing things away that I don't like, and I think I'll find some great help in your writing from just the passages that you share. I find that I much prefer to just push more things out of life. I don't like that. Let's go run away and find something else I like, and all of a sudden I need to push something away there. So I think that this would be very helpful.
Well, let me say that what this suggests is one, be intimate with the emotion that arises in that state, and two, realize your connection to what you think you're separate from. That's what this is saying, two modes. Turn toward the feeling, realize your connection. Turn toward the feeling, realize your connection, over and over again. Turn around the light to shine within, then just return.
The closing chant is on the front of the